He kōna e ipurangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
Haere mai. It's great to have you along for Country Life's final programme of the year. I'm Carol Stiles.
And I'm Duncan Smith. Kia ora. Today we have a lot on our plate. Kumara, strawberries, cherries and roast lamb.
Cosmo's taking care of the greens. He's out with growers in the biggest pea-producing region in New Zealand.
We're in Taranaki, having a chat to New Zealand's Dairy Woman of the Year, a woman who crams an awful lot into each 24 hours.
And we're sweetening things up a bit with a visit to an apiary.
But first, it's time to head around the regions. This week, we thought we'd have a chat to farmers and growers who'll be putting food on our tables this Christmas. First call to the north of the north.
Yep, hi there. I'm Anthony Blundell, Managing Director of Kaipa Kumara Limited in Ruawai. 2019's been a great year for Kumara. Sales and consumption are up by around about 6 or 7%. After a couple of seasons where supply was pretty tight due to weather conditions. Yeah, great bonus for consumers in 2019 for sure.
What type of kumaras do people still prefer?
Well, pretty much the red-skinned or Oiwairaka red kumara, which has been, you know, I guess what we've always called kumara. It's probably just a little bit under 50% of sales, but the Beauregard or orange flesh kumara, which was commercially introduced in the mid-90s, has actually risen to probably around about 45, 46%. So when you combine those two together, that's about 95%. Then you're making up the rest, the other 5%, with the gold and purple flesh varieties, which have just, the purple ones, just been introduced over the last 2 or 3 years. And one would imagine that orange kumara, which is an import from Louisiana, has become really popular and it may even overtake the traditional red-skinned kumara in the future.
Hi, Carol. I'm Darren from Strawberry Fields. We've got 10 hectares of strawberries in central Waikato off a third-generation family farm that have been growing strawberries for over 35 years.
How's the season going so far?
It's a terrible season. I just heard on the radio yesterday the price of strawberries is down 35%, and I think it'll be that plus more. Just oversupply, I think, or consumers not engaging. Not too sure.
And what about growing conditions? How have they been for strawberries?
Once the sort of warm weather kicked in, it's been a beautiful season for growing strawberries climatic-wise, and a very, you know, been sun for the last 2 or 3 weeks, and so great buying conditions, but we're just not getting the throughput of the sales. Strawberries have been the cheapest I've been for probably 5 or 6 years, $2 retail. That's a worrying thing. If the $2 retail is the new default price, that buy price is literally below the cost of production.
And do you have strawberries for Christmas?
Yes, I eat as many as I can, but only the best ones.
I'm Matthew Herbert. I'm a milk and cream producer from South Taranaki.
How's your year been, Matt?
It's actually been really, really good this year. We've had an absolute cracker of a season. Cows went into winter in really good condition, and winter was really kind to us. So they calved down in good condition, and they've been milking well all season. And summer's just starting to deliver for us now. We've got heaps of rain, got heaps of feed in front of us. We're getting paid really well for our product as well.
There's been a little bit of negativity around dairy farming this year. How have you coped with that?
Oh, to be honest, we just get on with what we're doing. We know that what we're doing is constantly working to improve our business every day, and how our business looks after the land and the environment that we're on. So we just focus on making sure that we're doing the best we can every day.
Now, Christmas dinner, where do you get your cream?
I'm actually a little bit lazy, and I let Fonterra do the work for me, and then I just buy the cream from the supermarket.
Hi, I'm Jason Palmer. I run a 500-tower farrow to finish operation down in Dunsandel, just south of Christchurch. We've had a reasonably encouraging year. Our schedules have started to move forward. We've had 2 years of reasonably below par schedules, and we're starting to see that turn at the moment. One of those influences in relation to African swine fever that's taken hold in parts of Asia. And the key for our industry is to make sure that we keep it out of New Zealand.
Have you got any advice for people who are looking out for a ham for Christmas?
Oh, definitely. You know, supporting local is obviously key. Approximately 60% of what we eat in New Zealand is imported pork. We'd like it to be the other way, but the reality is that that's where it's at. And obviously the more people that support local, the more opportunities we can grow and expand our operations. And obviously also there's a risk around African swine fever being contracted or brought into New Zealand through imported product, because that virus does exist in imported meat that comes into the country and can survive in it. So we want to reduce the amount that comes in to reduce the risk at farm level in New Zealand.
Are you having a ham this Christmas?
Dead right, I am. Probably two.
What's the best way to cook it?
I'm pretty keen on you peel the layer of fat off and then you score the ham both directions with a knife and then smother it in plum sauce and then throw a few cloves on top of that and then cook it on low for about, low 130 degrees for about 3 hours and then pull it out and carve it up and hoe into it.
Yes, hi, I'm Robin Oakley. I'm a potato grower from Canterbury.
What's happening with potatoes at the moment?
Well, depending what part of the country you're coming from, there are some new, genuine new season potatoes available that can be purchased at the moment, and we're still in parts of the country working on the last of the last season potatoes while the new ones are just getting ready to dig now.
Over the years, have you noticed any change in the way people are buying potatoes and the sort of potatoes people are buying?
Yes, well, generally speaking, people are buying smaller packs or buying individual potatoes out of the loose area at the store. There's a bit more of a swing now heading towards golden potatoes, and I think people are cottoning on to the fact that buying smaller sized potatoes, you get a faster cooking time, and a lot of them also being cooked now with skins on. Not many people peeling the potatoes like they used to be in the past.
Do you know how many kilograms of potatoes the average New Zealander eats a year?
Well, I think if you take across the fresh potatoes, French fries and potato crisps, I think it'd be in the vicinity of 50 to 60 kilos per person per year. And, of course, some of us keep the average up for the others.
Hi, I'm Jason Tyler from Cromwell down Central Otago here. We grow cherries. Had a bit of rain earlier in the week, but had the helicopters out. So fingers crossed there's not too much damage. Weather's been a bit difficult. The sun hasn't been out that often, so the season's run a little bit behind. But hopefully with a few good sunny days, we can get back on track. It's a long process to get them to where they are at the moment, so it all boils down to a few weeks around Christmas and New Year's.
What's the labour situation like?
Seems to be all right down here. Yeah, we've got enough pickers to get us through. We've got a lot of Czechs these days. A few Europeans and from UK, just generally backpackers. Fingers crossed they'll stick around. We can look after them, they'll stick around, I suppose.
How are the cherries looking?
Looking really good. Big and juicy, so, yeah, that seems to be what everyone wants.
David Rose from North Hope in Southland, and I'm a sheep and beef farmer.
How's 2019 been for sheep and beef farmers, David?
Well, The new season's looking really good, particularly for sheep. We're getting some record prices, although we need that with the cost structures we have with lambs. You know, getting up to that magical $150 and ewes up to nearly $200. You know, beef outlook's looking even brighter with the swine fever that's happened in China. There's been such a lot of pigs have to be slaughtered, over 200 million, that looks like these prices are going to stay up for a while. So it's all looking pretty positive on the product front.
But I have to ask, what about wool?
I guess this year what we've had is the emergence of what synthetic fibres actually do to the environment. We've actually seen the return of the paper bag in their supermarkets. So it's a no-brainer that wool will come back because it's natural, it's fire retardant, it has all those wonderful properties. It's going to put in a return at some stage. Can't say when, that's all. From a farming perspective, we'd like to think that this next year we would have more engagement in the environmental regulation. That's our only black spot. So there's a lot of stuff out there, a lot of emotion, and we want to have a factual debate because, after all, you know, like the T-shirt says, have you eaten today? And on the back it says, thank a farmer. So, you know, we're pretty important to our way of life. And we just want to engage in a way where we can look after the environment but not have ridiculous things put on us that mean that we can't carry on. So there's been 17,000 submissions to the essential freshwater package. So a bit more common sense in that space. After all, we're the ones that provide the food.
And speaking of food, what are you hoping people will be cooking on the barbecue this summer? Or for Christmas dinner, for that matter?
Well, I hope a leg of lamb or perhaps some nice steaks on the barbie. You know, we have top quality food in New Zealand. That's something we're known for worldwide. And, you know, pretty special time for family in that, and there's nothing better.
And as we mentioned, Cosmo will be dishing up something green for the plate later on Country Life.
Producing honey is in Barry Hance's genes. He's continuing the proud family tradition that started many years ago. Cosmo caught up with him a couple of months ago to find out about his beekeeping business at Lakeside near Leeston.
It's been going since about 1951, and we are a family-owned and operated business. I'm third generation, with my sister is in the business as well. We run 3,500 hives and about 1,000 nucleus hives, which we use for queen raising. And we also, in our business, we do a lot of pollination work and services. So especially for the small seed sector in the mid-Canterbury area, we probably shift about 2,000 hives for radish seed and carrot seed, which has been a big part of our business over the last 15 years. Mm. Yeah.
Now, we are standing in one of your processing sheds because the weather's pretty bad outside. Has your family always used this location as their base?
No, this has been here about 45 years. We did have our original extracting and processing place was 500 metres down the road from where we are now, and that's where my grandparents and my dad and his brother were brought up down there. And then they brought this section here and built this shed, and then when my uncle got out, they sold that place down the road.
Yes. What has changed since you first became involved in the family business?
The biggest thing that's probably changed in our business is the pollination side of things. So basically, when I first started, we probably shifted, you know, 200 hives a year for pollination. But now, as I said, we shift up to 2,000 for radish seed and carrot seed, and then we do quite a bit of blackcurrant pollination as well, where we probably shift 600 or 700 for that. That's probably been the biggest thing in our business. The other thing that's happened since in the 18 years since I've been here, like we, 18 years ago, we were probably getting, for clover honey, we were getting, I remember, sort of $3 to $4 a kg back then, and now we've come to the point where we are now, where the price of bulk honey, especially like the clover which we produce, is down to $2 and $3. So what we're getting now is what was less than what we got 18 years ago, and it's come because there's a huge surplus of honey in New Zealand, and that's because the hive numbers have increased in New Zealand. I think we're about at 915,000 roughly hives now, and that number 6 years ago was probably 400,000 450,000. So over the next few years, we're certainly in for some very tough times with trying to even sell honey. You know, I talked to one guy one day and he said, beekeeping is the only industry where at the beginning of the season, you have no idea if you're going to get a crop of honey or if you're going to sell it. If you're a dairy farm or whatever, you know that Fonterra are going to come and pick it up and do something with it. But with honey, we have no idea if we're going to be able to sell it. So what's happening now is a lot of beekeepers are trying to start their own brand and try and sell it domestically. And there's certainly been a few new products then up on the shelves.
Are you stockpiling any honey while you wait for clover honey prices to rise?
Not really. We work on the theory that you produce the product and you sell it in that next year and you take what you get and then you move forward. Obviously, with 12 or 13 staff, you need money coming in to pay wages and all those sorts of things. So we do sometimes, but not huge quantities like some people can sit on their whole crop for a year. But no, it's all about turning it over and you take what you get and move on. And yeah.
Does the popularity of Mānuka honey mean that other honeys are not selling as well?
No, I don't believe so. I think that there are certainly markets out there for the other types of honey, but it is tapping into it. The top-end Mānuka honey, there is still a market, and there still seems to be a growing market for that. But the other honeys is sellable, but it's just getting... It is getting the story out there, basically, about those honeys and how good they are as well. I mean, all honeys, some of them are just as good as Mānuka, but sometimes you just need to use more of it. Yeah.
Where is the season at now?
So we have done two visits to all our beehives just to check them after the winter, their food stores and their bee numbers, and making sure the queens are doing what they're meant to be doing. And hopefully the hives are getting up to strength, building up into the season gradually, and hopefully now we should start putting honey supers on the hives. As the bee numbers build up, we just give them more room, so we give them a box so they're ready to gather some clover honey when the clover starts to flower.
From what you've seen so far, are the bees looking healthy?
Yes, our bees have come through the winter and are looking a lot better than probably what we have seen in the last couple of years. We've done a few different things through the winter to do with varroa control, and I think that has helped us, and the bees have sort of taken off earlier. But the yields that we get compared to 10, 15 years ago or before we had varroa, I think are a little bit lower now.
What about the American fowl brood disease? Is that a big concern for you?
Yes, it's a big concern, and over the last few years we have had a bit of it. We thought we were on top of it 12, 18 months ago, but then we have, in a certain area, another beekeeper has had a huge outbreak of it, so we have picked up a few more from that. But basically, the Canterbury area is a sort of a real hotspot area for American fowl brood. So yeah, once we fawn hives with it, we have to we burn them, we destroy them. Yeah.
What impact does the disease have on a bee? What does it do to a bee?
So basically, it kills the larvae before the bee hatches. So if you don't do anything about it, the hive will die with it. And then what happens then is, once that hive dies, bees are very good at scavenging. So if they see honey in that hive and it's died out and it's got honey stores there, the other bees from the other hives will go in and rob that honey out and take it back to their own hive. And that's one way that the disease spreads.
So it spreads quickly?
Yes, yeah, quickly, and over a number of hives in a short period of time. But New Zealand has a plan to try and eradicate it, and we're one of the only countries in the world that have this plan to try and eradicate it. So you can treat it with chemicals, which they do with antibiotics, which they do in other countries, but that only masks it and sort of makes it go away, and then they can still do what they do. But I think that's a big selling point further down the track for our honey in the world market, is that we have this plan for it to try and eradicate it, and we don't use antibiotics in our hives. I think that's a big selling point for our product.
Yeah. Moving forward, what does the industry need to do to ensure that clover honey producers like yourself can survive?
I think the biggest thing going forward is basically trying to market our product and to market it overseas and get back into some of the markets where we used to be that we're not anymore. Like the European market was a big market for us, but because the honey prices went up so dramatically and domestically, and all the honey packers were buying in New Zealand, we shut ourselves out of those markets. We decided not to sell to those honey packers over there. But yeah, I think we will get our products back there, but it's going to take, 2 years at least, to get something over there.
Barry Hance from Hance Honey in Leeston.
This is Country Life on RNZ National 101 FM.
Carol's in South Taranaki now to meet a city slicker turned dairy farmer. It's fair to say Trish Rankin's embraced farming. She's this year's Fonterra Dairy Woman of the Year.
When I first started farming with Glenn, I was a teacher and I'd rear the occasional calf or maybe do some GST if I had to. And now there's not a lot I don't know. I don't like winding up fences, and I try and avoid that, but pretty much everything else I've learnt to do in the last 10 years.
As a teenager, could you imagine living a life on the land like this?
No, absolutely not. No, I'm scared of spiders, you know. Like, my parents just think it was hilarious that I'd go on a farm. And I remember getting the ute stuck in a wet paddock one day, and I went up to the shed. Dad was there. Went up to the shed, picked up the tractor, went down and towed myself out. And Dad was just shaking his head like, can't believe that's my daughter, who didn't even want to learn how to change a tyre in a car.
So you've had a pretty good couple of years, haven't you, being nominated for and winning the Fonterra Dairy Woman of the Year title. And you're also involved in lots of other things?
Yeah, I am. And it's all about following the things that you're most interested in. So obviously it started off doing things with my kids and for my career at school, so going on the boards of trustees or, you know, coaching soccer and umpiring cricket and all those things that you do. And then as we got sort of more involved in farming, I found a whole pile of fields in there that I was really interested in as well. So joining the Dairy Women's Network and helping them design a module using my education background, all the way through to doing some stuff with Dairy NZ, doing a little bit of work now with Ag Recovery. So there's just so many bits and pieces that you can find to interest you, depending on where your passions sit. And obviously for me, it's around the environment, it's around waste, it's around being a good employer, and there's just so many opportunities that if you just put your hand up and say to somebody, hey, I'm keen to get involved, someone will snap you up. And that's how I've been just so lucky to have Dairy Women's Network and Dairy NZ and winning that award, not through setting out to do it, but just by default of being really, really happy and passionate and keen to help the sector.
You said that you've got a particular interest in the environment and sustainability. Now, there are a lot of Taranaki farmers at the moment who are feeling really put upon. They're really, really worried about the future, what they may or may not be required to do, and they feel, I think, that they've already done a whole lot to protect the environment. Do you also get that sense of panic from farmers?
Oh, 100%.
What would you say to them?
You know, calm the farm is kind of our approach. You know, there's so much coming, so let's look at what you can control. I had a meeting in the last few weeks with a group of dairy environment leaders here in Taranaki, and we were like, okay, so there are things we can't control, and that is some of the policy that hasn't been released yet from government, like the freshwater policy is still under consultation. What can we control? So we went through a list of things, even things like being organised and ready for your dairy shed inspection and making sure that you've got all your paperwork up to date. What our theory is if we can get on top of all of those things that are sitting in your office in the to-do pile and get on top of them now, when the policies and the new regulations get released, it's not going to be something else to add into your to-do pile because you've already kind of tried to knock off most of the other stuff. The submissions that were received are obviously being reviewed now.
This is for the water?
For the freshwater policy, yep. Mm-hmm. And we certainly hope that there's some adjustments and some regionalisation of some of those policies because you're dead right. The riparian planting and some of the work that's been done here and a lot of the farmers that have been part of that have already done a whole heap of fencing and planting, and then to hear things like, oh yeah, we're actually going to make fences have to be 5 metres and they just have to be grass verges, just seems ridiculous when you might have a fence that's at 2 metres from a waterway and beautifully planted out, which would surely be stopping more leaching than just plain old grass. And the government have suggested that they'd just be happy with grass. So, you know, that's a kick in the guts for farmers who have planted thousands and thousands and thousands of trees. So it's about standing up, I think, too, for what we've already done. I know our regional councils did a submission, Dairy NZ did a submission on Taranaki's behalf. So there's been a lot of feedback to the government around how some of their stuff's just unrealistic.
What else is special about Taranaki? Because I know that you've got really fast-flowing waterways here.
Yeah, we have. Like, the mountain can take a whole pile of rain in a 24-hour period, and it can be out in the ocean within a few hours, depending on the volume obviously received. So it's not like a lot of water sits stagnant around the place. Everything's on a slope, and everything drains down from the mountain out to the ocean pretty quickly. We don't have stagnant rivers that meander through and take forever to find the outsource. Our water comes in and goes out, and that's an advantage to us, especially with our beautiful riparian planting preventing so much of the leachates entering the waterway anyway. I certainly hope that the government realises that they need to regionalise some of this legislation because you can't have one blanket rule for the whole of New Zealand.
You've also got high phosphorus levels in Taranaki.
Yeah, before it even reaches the first farm. It's just coming out of the mountain, coming out of the volcanic soils with the bird fowl. We've got high phosphorus before it even hits a farm. So that's unfair on farmers who are through those areas of high phosphorus to be told that it's farming practice that causes it before it even gets to the farm. It's already high. So there's definitely opportunity for the government to do better testing and better regulation, especially around that topic.
Another one of your interests is things that you can do on the farm to recycle, reduce your use of plastic.
Yeah, so it's certainly an area I thought that was going to be coming at us reasonably fast, was having to be very aware of farm plastics and the rubbish that we create. Nobody wants to fill up a skippy bin and have to take that to landfill, so I've been looking at ways to reduce that. Even little things that have been helping. We use a spray contractor, so we don't actually have to buy 200 litre drums of chemical sprays, store them in our facility and hopefully use it all up before it expires, and if it doesn't, you know, have to get rid of it. You know, if we use a spray contractor, he can obviously just use to the precise millilitre how much we need. And so we don't have to store the chemicals, we don't have to deal with them, and when he comes in, he uses what he needs and there's no wastage. So that's been one thing for us about finding the efficient ways of using products. We've just got a set to trial on plastic rubberware. Now, rubberware is a thing we use in the shed to put the cups on the cows. It's the product that goes on the cow teats, and that ends up just in landfill because you're unable to recycle that currently in New Zealand. So a New Zealand company based over in the Hawke's Bay has invented a plastic polymer version of that, which is 100% recyclable. So you use it for twice as many milkings. You can use it for 5,000 milkings as opposed to 2,500 for rubberware. And then you can send it back to them and they'll melt it down and they'll make a certain proportion of it back into the same product again, and then the rest of it becomes slightly lower grade, but it gets made into plastic matting. And that's just the start of this innovation and creation. So you can certainly see how a lot of companies now are looking to see what can they do for us. And farmers need to make really good purchasing decisions. So even when you're at your local dairy supply store or farm supply store, look for those ones that have got the Ag Recovery logo on them, because then you know that they can be recycled. I think the more farmers start to recycle or even push back to manufacturers, hey, I don't want that product because it's just creating rubbish, then the manufacturers are going to need to change what they're doing too.
Have you gone about it? Have you just looked around your farm and thought, okay, what's something else I can do instead of?
Yeah, pretty much. Just applying that process of thinking. So things like, what can we reuse? What can we repair? What can we reduce the use of? What can we refuse to use? You know, once you start telling people you want to change, then you'll find, you know, we've sort of found the people who provide our service, even our local vets, when they dropped off something, we can come back and pick up this rubbish and take it to recycling for you. Thank you very much. That'd be great.
Is it easy enough to do?
Oh, it's 100% easy, but it takes time, not money. So I can get my skippy bin emptied for $164. I can chuck it in there and get it emptied. If I want to recycle, I drive 20 minutes to Farmlands for my farm recycling. I drive 5 minutes to Manaia for all the other glass, paper, cardboard recycling. So it takes my time.
And time's something you're a bit short of, because you're teaching as well?
Yeah, so I do. I'm really lucky that Opanaki Primary work around the days that I can do for them. So at the start of every term, I just give them a list of all the dates that I'm available. They generally take them all. And this week I did 2 days, last week I did 3. And I'm doing a whole pile of study as well. So I try and keep things, you know, Thursday tends to be stay at home, do housework, do my study, kind of a day where I don't try and sign up for too much. Friday's farm day, because our worker has Fridays and Saturdays off. She's on a 5 and 2. So Fridays and Saturdays I milk. And Sunday's family day, where we go down to Opanaki Surf Lifesaving and have a really great time down there and do junior surf. And the kids' sports keep you busy every night of the week.
Because you've got 4 children.
Yeah, 4 boys. You're super lucky to be in Taranaki, though. Like, nothing's more than about 20 minutes away. Whether it's rugby practice at Kaaponga or surf lifesaving at Opanaki. Yeah, it's just everything's so close.
Because you were in Northland.
Yeah, we moved up to Northland just so we could get into herd owning shear milking. It was really difficult. We were in the Hawke's Bay Wairarapa area, and it was very hard in those days. It was only 4 years ago, but really hard to get a 50-50 job. So we just said, right, we'll go wherever we where we can get one, and it happened to be in the back blocks of the North Hokianga, where there was three dairy farms sort of in a 100k radius, so it didn't get much difficult than that. But the beauty of it was at the $3.90 payout, we paid cull price for our cows. So we paid sort of $600 or $700 to get into to she milking, as opposed to where down here you'd still be paying $1,800 a cow. You know, we could get into she milking for a third of the cost of what you'd usually pay for 300 cows. Yeah, it was pretty good for us. We got really good habits about spending and didn't buy anything that wasn't necessary and fixed everything ourselves, because where we lived, we were 2 hours away from the nearest dairy shed technician. If something broke down, you fixed it. So, you know, it was hard, and we certainly lived off the smell of an oily rag, but that set us up for having really good business ethos to then take this position down here.
Have you still got some of those cows?
Well, we brought them all down from Northland to here, and you can't see them today, but they got off the truck after having lived on hills in the Hokianga on clay country with Kaikuia, a grass species, which is a really nightmare to manage, to the flat green rye grass of Taranaki. You could see the cows smile. When they got off the truck, they were like, oh my God, where are we? And we've still got so many of those cows now because they learnt how to eat the hard way. They learnt to eat on hills and learnt to eat tough, sour tasting grass, probably. I don't know what Kaikuia you taste like, but it always looked a bit stringy. And now they're here, and you know, they've doubled their milk production, and they just smile all the way to the milking shed, really.
Trish Rankin. She's also on the National Executive of the New Zealand Dairy Awards, is a Kellogg Rural Leader, and last year was selected as a Climate Change Ambassador as part of the Dairy Action for Climate Change.
People might not know about farming. Well, some people might not know that we actually do a really good job. We love our animals, we look after them to the best of our ability, and we actually do really care what happens to them.
Country Life, 101 FM.
To continue our look at typical Christmas Day fare, we're turning our attention to the humble pea. New Zealand produces about 60,000 tonnes of peas a year, earning about 50 million in domestic sales and 80 million in exports, primarily as frozen peas. Most of New Zealand's peas are grown in Canterbury, and Cosmo's been out to meet growers Chris Morrish and his father David at their farm between Christchurch and Lincoln. David, who's in his 80s, started growing peas for Watties when Chris was a toddler. Today, all of the crop still heads to the Watties factory. Cosmo's also catching up with Simon McCormick and Maddie Hampton. They're crop supply agronomists. It's their job to work with farmers to make sure the crops are at their best. We'll hear from them later. But first, Chris is giving Cosmo a rundown of the farm.
We're a mixed arable farm. With 300 hectares, and pretty much of that 300 hectares is 260 odd hectares harvested every year with a header or a Watties harvester of some sort. And then we run a lot of sheep after the crops have gone off on the residues, or we grow green feed. So we run about 800 ewes and lamb them, and then we top up with winter lambs of anywhere between 2,500 to 3,000 lambs and fatten them through the winter on feed that we've planted for them after crops that are at quick rotation.
Now we are standing beside a large paddock of peas. Where are things at with these peas?
So these have just been watered, so they're not flowering yet. Normally we wouldn't water them until we see the first flower, but it's been so hot and dry they were looking a bit thirsty. So they've been watered. It's just had some fish fertiliser on it 10 days ago. Just I find that sort of kicks things along a bit. And that's pretty much, other than water to harvest now. We don't grow, put any fungicides on. So these are generally don't get any herbicides or anything on, but this one has had a herbicide on. We had a lot of grass kicking in the bottom of it.
So, So is this quite a hardy cultivar?
Yes, there's only really two cultivars, and they're both pretty hardy. Some of your late peas, I believe, you still put fungicide on later on, but we don't really have to worry about that.
Yes.
So they're quite a quick crop, about 100 days from planting to harvest, generally. So the paddock's not tied up a long time. We get paid the 20th month after harvest. And then we can turn the paddock around quite quickly and put some green feed in to fatten these lambs.
Is this crop of peas here destined for the Christmas market?
No, we're later than that. We used to be harvested before Christmas, but this would be more like 10th, 15th of January. So these will be export, I presume.
And how many tonnes per hectare can you do?
Oh, if they go somewhere in 8 to 10 tonne to hectare, depending on the TR, which is what maturity they harvest them at. So the higher the TR, the higher the yield will be, but the lower the TR, which will be the younger pea, they won't yield as well.
Yes, yes. In terms of crop management, what are your main challenges when growing a pea crop?
To have a decent gap from the last pea crop. So you want 5 years, really, minimum, otherwise you get disease.
Gosh, that's a long time.
Yeah, but that's why they slot into the rotation nicely as a restorative crop through the cereals. And so we grow a lot of wheat, and then there's ryegrass, barley and clover, paddocks of radish, all other small acreages of crops as well. But the broad acre stuff are the basics. But the peas, you can't bang them in too quickly. You've got to have that gap.
It must be quite challenging managing the land you've got to ensure that you can do that 5-year rotation.
It's not as hard as... Well, Dad, I had a good teacher, like for 300 hectares, I sat down there the other night and sort of penciled in the rotation for next year, and within an hour, the nuts and bolts of it are there. I'm not saying that's exactly what it'll be, but there's flexibility there, but it's not that bad once you get your head in that space.
Yes. Is it a good cash crop for you,
Peace? 95% of the time. Last year we didn't do so well out of two paddocks of peas because it was just too wet, November, December, and peas don't like getting wet. But the other paddock was good for some reason.
Yes.
I think it was rotation.
And this year crops are growing okay?
Up until this last fortnight where it's been so hot and dry and windy, and we're struggling to keep up with the water really. But they're looking, there's potential still there.
So how do you irrigate these peas?
On this block, we're still under a Briggs Rotorainer, which is one of the ones that goes round and round, covers 100 metres. We've just put a new lateral on this other side, and it's got the potential to turn around and do this block, but we've only just done that this year, and so this year we're still under Rotorainer. And in these dry years, I don't think the new lateral's got the ability to do all this block on this other side, turn around, do this block, and then get back to the other end. So I think it'll probably stay under Rotorainer.
And where does your water come from?
So we've got a bore with very good water. It's quite a deep one, but it comes nearly to the top, so it's nearly artesian. But that's all got meters and everything on, and we can't go over our consent. You know, we've got a consent per second to pump to. And
yes. If you didn't irrigate this crop, would the yields be much, much lower?
Yeah, we wouldn't be farming here now, I don't think. If we didn't have water, this farm would be probably subdivided and have houses on it. That's such the difference that water makes. Yeah, and you get these dry years. Like, this was a pretty good farm, dry land, but the water just cranks it up. And there's so much investment in the crops now. Capital outlay on fertiliser and sprays and even seeds. Your investment in machinery, it's just, you've got to get good results.
Yes.
You won't stay in business.
Now, in a paddock in the distance, a tractor is putting some beans in, is that right?
That's correct. That's for Waddies as well, yep. So they'll be harvested probably by the end of February, so they're quite a quick crop. But they go in at the trickier time of year where they need a lot of water. But then the rest of the farm, come mid-January, doesn't need much water, so you can concentrate on growing the beans.
And the dust coming up from behind the tractor shows how dry the land is getting.
Yeah, it's quite dry on top, but that's been irrigated beforehand, so if you scratch down about 2 inches, there's very good moisture there. And that other irrigator will be over it by Friday and put on 5 or 10 mils and we'll be in business.
Now, you mentioned your dad before. David, could I have a chat with you?
Yes, sure.
How long have you been farming here?
Started here about
1966.
How different was farming then?
Oh, a lot of difference, yes. You struggled to get good crops in those days. Well, you didn't put the fertiliser on for a start, so the crops weren't so heavy and bulky.
And climate-wise, was the weather different then?
I don't think so. You got your hot years, you got your cold years, and it seemed to be about the same as we're getting now. I don't think there's a hell of a lot of climate change going on.
Now, your family has been farming around here for 150 years,
yeah,
I believe.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Oh, well, I can go back 84 years when Dad and had the old tin mill and the steel wheel tractors. And I've grown up through all that to the latest ones now where they nearly steer themselves. But no, things have changed a lot. It's not a, you're not out in the country really now. It's too much going on around you. Some days you'd go for hours out in the tractor and see no one, but now there's always somebody around.
What do you love about farming?
Oh, just in my blood. Been doing it all the life. I started driving a tractor when I was 9 years old. I've been involved with harvest for 74 years, driving headers or... Yeah, first header I can remember we started up home, in the home block there, 1944, and I was driving the tractor and pulling the little header behind, and old Herb Cochran at Leaston, he was on the bag platform of the header and he's doing this, you know, waving his hand, "Go faster, boy." I wonder what the hell he was meaning. That was my first experience of farming.
When did you first start growing peas here?
Oh, way back when we didn't have water. Yeah. We grew the first crop of peas for what is 49 years ago at least. And they were short and they were hard to pick up. And now you've got no trouble getting underneath them and getting them all. But
it's a lot quicker.
A lot quicker and you left a lot behind because you couldn't get down low enough to get underneath them.
Yes.
They were on the ground that hard.
And I guess the sheep would have enjoyed cleaning up.
Oh, yes, they do.
And still do.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, David.
That's all right. You're welcome.
Now, I might pass that over to you, Simon.
Well, Cosmo, I'm pretty fortunate to have spent my life with peas. This is will be the 42nd harvest for me, or 42nd year with Waddies. And... yeah, and in that time I've seen a factory at Christchurch go from doing 4,000 or 5,000 tonnes to over 30,000 tonnes. It's really grown, and that's what's kept us all involved. We have a great depth of growers who contract with us every year. We have a great team who come back every year and operate our harvesters. And in the factory we have a fair bit of experience there. And I think every year we look back and think, well... we made the odd mistake. Things didn't quite go how we would like them to, weather-wise. So, you know, we've got to start again, and we get that opportunity every year to start again and go through the season, hopefully planting as much as our marketing people can handle and also harvesting every crop. It's a very important thing for our growers to see us come in the gate and take them away.
And Canterbury is the main region for growing peas in the country, isn't it?
It is now. McCain's operate in Hastings, where I guess Sir James started. We've concentrated here in central Canterbury. Tally's out of Ashburton, and very, very good cropping growers in Canterbury. Very good irrigation system available to us through the... I look back at the pioneers, Trevor McMillan. The person I worked for at Lyndhurst, Jack McKendry, was responsible for the Bar Hill Chertsey irrigation scheme. Yeah, and all that's... their foresight has led to, you know, us being able to produce peas, you know, better than anywhere in the world.
Are you on hand to assist your farmer clients whenever there's an issue?
Yep, there's four of us in Christchurch. Phil and I have been at it for a long time, Nigel. And, we're lucky now I can pass on my experiences to Maddie Hampton, who joined us last year. I tell everybody I found Maddie on a carrot harvester in Bar Hill, and so it's good to have someone young in our team. And that's our life. We, from planting to harvest, we keep an eye on them. There's not too many things you can do to peas to along the journey, but you do have to plant them into a very good seed bed and keep an eye on watering. One shot of spray really for weeds, and that's really it. And right now we're busy. The factory's been running for over a fortnight, probably 3 weeks now, and it's 24 hours, 7 days a week. We just won't run out, I don't think. Maybe Christmas Day is the plan.
Talking about Christmas, do you have to get extra peas in to satisfy the festive demand?
Well, the good thing is it seems every year when we start at the end of November, we seem to be empty zero stores, so the world is screaming out for our peas, and that includes New Zealand. And yeah, today we are in a position, I'm not sure whether they'll actually, probably will, but we're harvesting peas at Southbridge right now that'll be perfect for the Christmas market if that's where they end.
Now, you use something called a pea tendometer that crushes peas and gives you a reading of tenderness. Is that right?
Yeah, well, the pea crop, when it gets to maturity, there is a point where it's still too young to harvest, but when it's very young, it has a reading on the pressure test of 90, and from 90 to sort of midway point, ideal for New Zealand and Australian customers. And then after that, quite a lot of our peas are harvested at the end of their maturity, 130, 140 on the tenderometer. Unfortunately, we have about a 6 to 7 day window from that young to old, but it is a way. All our farmers know when we should be there to harvest them, and we're lucky, really. We turn up 90% of the time on time.
Yes. Now tell me what happens to the peas when they leave this farm, because the Waters factory is actually only, what, 5 km from here?
Well, we're still fortunate. It's very precious to us to have them close to the factory. So they'll get to the factory, they're pretty much just all we really do to them is wash them, give them a quick blanch, and into the tunnels for freezing. I think they take about 15 minutes down the tunnel and they're frozen. So yeah, and another thing that keeps our quality right up there is that within the world we are quite quick from being potted to being frozen. Probably the longest journey we have would be just on an hour in the truck.
I might just grab Maddie now, if that's okay. Thank you. Maddie, Simon said you've recently come on board as an agronomist for Waters. What's it like working with farmers like Chris and David?
I say I'm very, very lucky to be working with growers like this. We have built up, Waters I think have built up a great relationship with growers, and I say I learn the most in my job off my growers, to be fair. They're very patient, they've been very patient with me starting. I've been very new to peas, especially the crops, so I'm very thankful for them. And yes, Same with our agronomist team, I've learned a lot of them, they've been great.
What's your background?
My background is farming, crop farming and racehorses, and then I went to Lincoln Uni and studied agriculture science. And then I was on a dairy farm and on a carrot harvester, and this is where Simon found me. And then I applied for the job and I was very lucky to get it.
And in terms of the peas, what sort of things do you talk about with Chris and David?
Oh, the main thing is you keep an eye on weeds, definitely, and we're working out planting dates. If there's problems with weather, we can't plant them on time. Seed, sorting out that. And then, of course, when it's close to sampling, we've got to keep in contact with them and then work out when the harvesters are going to come.
So are you pretty happy with the crop of peas in front of us?
Yes, I am. Yes, it's looking beautiful. There's nothing more satisfying than watching crops being planted, watching them through the whole process grow, and then them being processed in the factory. It's why I do this job.
Do you enjoy what you do? Do you love growing crops like peas?
Yes. I do enjoy growing. I enjoy growing all sorts of crops. Peas are just one of our strings, but they're quite satisfying when it's a nice crop and you get those results emailed to you and you go, yep, we nailed that. That's good. Another good result. And that's all why we're doing it. You know, we're here to feed the world, but we're here to produce food and try and do it sustainably, which I think we are doing it. The farm's still kicking out good results. We've probably got a lot smarter about the way we do things. We do a lot of soil testing, deep end testing, moisture probes. It's got quite scientific, so it's very rewarding.
Mm. And in terms of Christmas Day, are peas on the menu for you?
Peas will be on the menu in between shifting irrigators, probably.
A busy time of the year.
We try and organise it so there's not so much to do on Christmas Day, but I quite like getting out of the house for a couple of hours. I take the dog and a bit of downtime.
Chris Morrish ending that story in a paddock of peas near Leeston. Cosmo was also talking to his dad, David, as well as to crop supply agronomists Simon McCormick and Maddie Hampton from Waters. And nearly 6.9 million tonnes of peas are produced worldwide every year.
Wouldn't want to count them.
Well, that's it for Country Life for 2019. It's been great to have your company this year. Thanks for lending us your ears. Country Life wouldn't get to air each week without the skills of RNZ sound engineers and David Knowles, who works behind the scenes to keep us on track. We really get the chance to acknowledge you. So, thank you. Also, a huge thanks to the ag and hort consultants, the farmers and growers dotted around the country who pick up the phone or email in each Friday and tell us what's been happening in their patch. A lot of them tell us they like to do their bit to bring the town and country a bit closer. You do. And to the people who have welcomed us and our microphones onto their land, their farms, their orchards and into their homes and communities this year, you make Country Life.
And we're taking a break, but we'll be back with new stories from the countryside at the end of January. The 24th's our first day back on air, but in the meantime, we've put together a summer series of some of our favourite stories from 2019. You can hear them on Friday nights at 9 and Saturday mornings after 7 in the usual Country Life slot. You can also have a browse through old episodes on the Country Life webpage on the RNZ website. Have a wonderful Christmas.
Until next year, goodbye.
Bye now.